Now is the time set for argument on case number 80636, which is regarding the Newport Corporation shareholder litigation. We have all counsel appearing remotely by video. I have myself and Justice Herndon sitting in the Carson City courtroom, and Justice Pickering is sitting in the Las Vegas courtroom. So we extended the time frame to 20 minutes per side, recognizing that sometimes there's time delays in remote arguments, so we thought a little extra time might make some sense. So that's why we did that. Okay, so first up for appellants, you please let us know if you would like to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Randall Barron. I'm counsel for plaintiff's appellant, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if that's okay with the court.
Sure. So what will happen is the yellow light and a tone will go off when you get down to 5 minutes, but the time still keeps running. So it's up to you to actually say, I want to reserve the rest of my time. Otherwise, you're using it up. Okay. With that, you can go ahead and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. The record in this case is fulsome, to say the least, and there are dozens of documents within the record that, you know, describe in plenty of intrigue within the corporation, including internal squabbles and fights and conflicts, undisclosed restructuring plans, taking credit for those restructuring plans, millions of dollars in undue benefits, spurned bidders. But at its core, what this case is about, Your Honors, is a corporation CEO and CFO who are concealing information from their own board of directors for self-interested reasons. And because of that deceit, the company is sold for less than what it is worth, and in fact, less than what the ultimate buyer was even willing to pay. And shareholders under this court's law, under the recent decisions of Wynn, Chur, and Guzman, are entitled to recover those damages that are causally related to that conduct. Before the court today, we have three issues, and they're relatively separate, although I think the last two work together. We have the issue of a jury trial, we have the issue of leave to amend, and the summary judgment. I hope to only spend a minute or two on the jury trial so we can spend the rest of the time on the leave to amend and the summary judgment. As to the jury trial, I don't think there's much to say that we haven't briefed in detail. I want to emphasize two points. One is that the Nevada Constitution expressly prescribes for a jury trial in the state of Nevada. And two, that we are not, with this case, asking a jury to do something that juries do not do all the time. Indeed, while we explain in detail why this is not an equity case and is instead a law case seeking damages, the reality is that distinction between law and equity is one in which is for convenience of juries, where you have courts having to make balancing decisions in whether or not, you know, trees are coming down or how we are allocating between parties. Those are nuanced decisions that we found are difficult for jurors to make. But a decision which is fundamentally a tort, and indeed, as you restated in Guzman, there's just three elements which are the same three elements of any tort. There is a duty, a breach of that duty, and causal damages. And because of that, that is easy for courts to do. And we have the benefit in this state of actually having evidence of courts being able to do that in both the Clark v. Leverett case and the Binkeroff case that ultimately went up on appeal. And in neither of those situations did any of the parties or the court say a corporate breach of fiduciary duty is too difficult for a jury to decide. I want to move on, if I may, to leave to amend. And I think the leave to amend argument is significant because, in our view, that is the easiest path to what we think is appropriate here, which is fundamentally giving the trial court a do-over. And we think it's the easiest path because, indeed, it's probably the easiest issue for this court to decide. Denying leave to amend when you have a statute that expressly says leave to amend should be granted freely was an abuse of discretion clearly here. And particularly in this case where the parties themselves agreed to the timing of that amendment. It was in the scheduling order. In fact, it was in multiple scheduling orders because there were some delays and we had some problems getting documents from defendants. And so therefore we kept on revising that scheduling order. In one instance, the defendants actually drafted the revision. In that they included the date for leave. They included the date for leave to amend occurring at the close of discovery for the very purpose of being able to allow the information in. And the court approved this each and every time. Moreover, the court, when denying it, actually made the kind of findings that would demonstrate that leave should be granted. She expressly found multiple times that the amendment was quote unquote timely. She expressed that while the defendants argued that it was the amendment was futile, that she's not considering that. So she did not make a finding of futility. And because of that, there's no basis for doing so. And I think the proof that there's no basis is that neither side could present a single document, a single case in which leave to amend was denied when it was timely, when it was done at the time the parties in the court already agreed that it should be. Defendants cite some 38 cases on the issue of leave to amend, and not one of those was a denial when, in fact, it was filed timely.
Counsel, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Let me follow up on that. I understand it was before the deadline for seeking leave to amend, but it was quite some time into the litigation after the close of discovery and was seeking to make some pretty significant changes, adding this claim for a category of damages that should not have been a surprise to anyone at that point, and seeking to add a party that also the parties were aware of. So haven't we held that simply being before the deadline doesn't mean it's automatically a rubber stamp grant?
I don't think you've ever held the opposite. There's not a single case that has ever held that when you do meet that deadline, it is not. And the reason for there being decisions later were, one, they were aware of the damages because the damages remedy was set forth in the expert reports that they had well before that. And per agreement by the party, as far as detailing those damages numbers, we all had agreed that those would be disclosed with our experts because that's how you measure damages in a corporate breach of fiduciary duty case. As far as the new party, we knew he was a CFO, but some of the most critical evidence came in the form of text messages that we literally did not get until the very, very, very end of the discovery after we had already moved that out. So again, I don't think there's any authority for that. And again, there's no finding and there's no indication that there's prejudice. And this court has repeatedly said, if you have to do some subsequent discovery, that alone isn't prejudice. And indeed, they don't have to do anything on the damages. And throughout the case, the defendants did no affirmative discovery on any of the pre-existing claims. So there's no reason to believe, and they don't cite what bulk of evidence they would have to do based upon that amendment. So I don't sort of run completely out of time. I do want to emphasize that I think that if the court does grant the leave to amend, we can go back to the trial court. We will have a complete complaint with all the parties, all the damages remedies, all any new allegations for actually factual support, although it was in the record, for a court to consider if defendants would choose to bring a summary judgment at that time. And I think that provides what I say is the most straightforward path moving forward. If I can, I'd like to now move to the summary judgment. And is the issue of summary judgment, I think it's what I'd like to do is move forward on just two issues that I think establish that there's evidence in the record that the trial court either got absolutely wrong or that the trial court ignored, which demonstrates that at a minimum there is material issue that we should go forward on exactly the claims that this court has said we are entitled to go forward on under Wynn, Scher, and most recently Guzman. The two issues that I want to discuss are the issues of the self-interest of Lippi and Cargill and the concept of fraud on the board that took place, and that's on three specific areas of fact. As to self-interest, the evidence is clear, and what we have alleged as court of this case is that both Mr. Filippi and Mr. Cargill are better off having sold the company than they would be had they been fired and had they lost their jobs. And the evidence here that we have that they actually have this motive brings me back a bit to the court's decision in Guzman, where the court said that possibility that you would lose your job was just speculative. And indeed, the plaintiffs there had no basis to believe that the controlling shareholder or anybody else was going to fire them. Here, there is evidence. And while the trial court said, quote, there is no evidence that Mr. Filippi had a self-interest or motive to conceal the plan, or that there is evidence that there were any, or that the benefits to Mr. Filippi were material to him, the evidence shows exactly to the contrary. There is no, the court made no finding at the Cargill because, again, the court denied the motion for leave to amend, so therefore didn't consider any evidence for Mr. Cargill. As to Mr. Filippi, the evidence is replete that the most significant shareholders, not some random shareholders, most significant shareholders in the company were screaming for his firing. That they were not just writing, you know, a single letter. There were multiple letters. There were in-person conversations. There were conversations with the chairman of the board. And that evidence is replete in the record. There's evidence that the board didn't just push them aside. And there's no evidence that says the board said, no, we're going to keep him. What the board said instead, and there's an email in the record for that, which specifically says, you know, there's a lot of criticism. We may need a new team. So, again, the evidence is replete. There's also evidence of them limiting his abilities and stepping in and possibly usurping his Mr. Filippi's authority. There's also evidence that this is significant benefit to Mr. Filippi. The evidence is unrebutted, and we put an expert evidence and affidavit into the record, which indicates that Mr. Filippi, had he been fired, as they were talking, would have made approximately $1.2 million in golden parachute benefits and not taken any of his equity awards. By contrast, because of a change of control agreements and his ability to accelerate his equity awards and a post-acquisition employment agreement that he got, he was able to get about $5.7 million as a result of the merger.
Let me interrupt you there. There is no evidence that the post-sale agreement, that he had that agreement before the deal was approved, correct?
There's no evidence that he had that agreement. So we're talking about $618,000 out of the $5.7 million, first of all. So, yes, there's no indication that he had that. But there is evidence in the record that shows that in his own handwritten notes that he was planning to talk, that he was intending to and anticipated was talking to MKS about retention and future employment and compensation. So in his own notes, whether he was doing it or he was contemplating that, we do have evidence in the record that raises a material issue of fact on that. Let me jump real quick to Mr. Cargill. Like Mr. Filippi, he knew his job was in jeopardy. More importantly, Mr. Cargill actually was going to leave because of the conflict and was going to leave the company after Mr. Filippi tried to fire him and the board said, you're not allowed to do this yet. What we have in the record is an email from general counsel that specifically says, it is in your best interest to wait for a merger, because his reasoning was that my change of control agreement is better than my employment severance agreement. So you have direct evidence saying that for Mr. Cargill, he does better if there is a merger than if he simply left the company. And again, for him, he got, you know, some over $2 million as change of control benefits. Let me run real quick because I'm running out of time and I have my own limitation. On fraud on the board, there's three areas. The areas are the fairness projections, which are the base case projections. The board was never told what management believed about those. Management believed that those were not run the company numbers. The management believed that, quote, they were very preliminary and only intended as a starting point. These are quotes from documents. They believed that they were, quote, overly pessimistic. They agreed in all caps by Mr.
May Filippi. I interrupt you for a moment? Absolutely. I have a couple of specific questions. Did the Newport board have access to the data room that was shared with MKS during the diligence?
The Newport board, I suppose, could have asked to. They are not on any emails. There is no evidence that the Newport board had direct involvement or was actually in the data room in any way.
But you would concede that they had access to it had they asked for it?
I don't concede one way or the other. I have never seen a situation in which a board asked to go into the data room. So I do not know if a board asked to do that anybody would say no to them. But that is not a regular course of conduct or a practice within the board in a merger and acquisition. So I doubt that anybody even thought of that.
Okay. And was the strategic plan published to shareholders in prior years, or is it strictly an internal forecasting tool?
I believe that it is strictly an internal forecasting tool, and I don't believe that they publish any projections to at all. So neither the base case were prepared for some reason other than acquisitions, which is what it was prepared for, would never be in a proxy. All of this information would only be in the context of a decision to sell the company, right? So if we're going, I take that back. They would probably publish or at least release what their annual operating plan numbers were for at least the first year of that. But I don't have specific information as to whether they'd ever done more than that in the past.
And did the business units assume that they would receive their requested capital dollars when forecasting revenue projections and growth in the strategic plan?
Yes, I believe they did.
Thank you.
So I'm just going to take my time for rebuttal because I think it's important that I get to that. I want to make that Mr. Cargill himself acknowledged that the information provided to the board was never used for business. Mr. Filippi indicated that he knew that they were traditionally operating at 5% year-to-date growth, and the base case was only 3. None of this information was shared with the board of directors. So not only did they not know anything about the strategic plan, they did not know about the flaws in the plan that they were using. With regard to the strategic plan, I think it's important, again, that not only was the strategic plan not provided to the board of directors, there is each and every one of the directors testified they didn't know anything about it, and therefore the court's ruling that there is no evidence that they were complete or reliable is also disproved. Mr. Filippi said they were intended to be as accurate and realistic as possible. They were given to MKS when MKS asked for the most realistic and most up-to-date numbers. When the board was told what was given to MKS, they were lied to, and they were told that they were just given the base case numbers as updated and not the strategic plan. They were the very numbers that were used to operate the business moving forward. And most importantly, they were the numbers that actually established that the company was worth $2.96 per share more, or up to $110 million more. So they were material. And finally, the last issue was that Mr. Filippi was specifically told that MKS would be willing to pay more, and that they did not. I'm going to reserve my last 40 seconds for rebuttal, if I may.
Sure. Let me, I'll add another 2 minutes to your rebuttal time and add 2 minutes to respondent's time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure. So who's going first for respondents?
I believe I'm the only one arguing for respondents, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. And it's Mr. Lipschitz?
You got it, Your Honor. Thanks for taking the time to pronounce that correctly.
I'm sensitive to that. Nobody ever gets my name right, but that I digress. Go on.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joshua Lipschitz from Gibson Dunn, and I represent these six individual Newport Director defendants in this case. There's very little left, as Your Honors heard from the argument that was just presented. There's very little left of plaintiff's case at this point. They assert a single claim against each of the six individual defendants, arguing that each of them has breached their fiduciary duties and should be held personally liable for the board's approval of an all-cash acquisition of the Newport Company at a 53% premium to the company's stock price. This is a merger that plaintiffs initially tried to block before they changed their minds. Plaintiffs make no arguments at all, none in their briefs, none here today, about five of the six individual director defendants. So right off the bat, there is no question that summary judgment should be affirmed against those five defendants. And of course, those five defendants make up a majority of the board that approved this merger at $23 per share. So what is left of plaintiff's case? The case seems to boil down now to this. Mr. Filippi, Newport's CEO for 8 years, supposedly perpetrated a fraud on the rest of the board of directors, pulled the wool over all of their eyes, when he supposedly failed to tell the board that his management team was in the process of putting together a strategic plan for the business that was part of the company's routine annual strategic planning process. And, because that's not enough to prove their case, and they're arguing, and they must prove, that if only the board had known about this strategic plan, they would never have approved the merger at $23 per share. After 3.5 years of litigation, the trial court correctly found that plaintiffs had not adduced any material evidence to support any of this far-fetched theory. This was a very sophisticated board of directors. These were the founders of technology companies, the CEOs of major corporations. There was a 17-year member of Congress and the former head of the Securities and Exchange Commission on the board. The board had 47 years of combined experience as directors of Newport. This was a board that knew the company very well. The sale process itself spanned 9 months and involved 9 different potential bidders, 5 of whom engaged in diligence on Newport's business. This was a thorough market test of the value of Newport. The deal price at $23 per share, as I mentioned, was a 53% premium to Newport's stock price, but perhaps more importantly, it was higher than the company had traded in 13 years. And the directors in this case all testified that the company was not growing and that something needed to be done. And in fact, several of the directors testified that they would have taken a smaller premium for the company. This was far better. $23 per share in cash, where the company had not traded in 13 years, was far better than allowing this business to continue to operate. the board's financial advisors, who were J.P. Morgan, highly sophisticated and competent investment bank, provided a fairness opinion that $23 represented fair value for the company. And on top of all of that, the shareholders and the market in general were extremely positive about the deal when it was announced. 99.4% of shareholders voted in favor of it, including one of the lead plaintiffs in this case. Yet plaintiffs would have this court believe that the entire merger would have been scuttled if only the board had known about the strategic plan. Well, as an initial matter, of course the board knew about the strategic plan. The strategic planning process occurred every year and was scheduled to be completed and presented to the board in the spring of that year, just as it had been done every year before that. You can find that in all over the record. I would urge the court to look at 6 JA 1277, 1285, 12 JA 2808, among many other places. Nevada's business judgment rule says expressly that directors and officers in deciding upon matters of business are presumed to act on an informed basis. So the presumption is that the directors did know about the strategic plan and the strategic planning process. It is plaintiff's burden to prove with evidence that the directors did not know about the strategic plan. And that evidence does not exist. In fact, Mr. Phillippe himself testified in his testimony, undisputed evidence, quote, "There was certainly a dialogue with the board about the fact that the strategic plan was something that we were working on as a matter of course." And Mr. David Allen testified in his deposition, quote, "Yes, this would be the normal course of putting together a business plan, just like the year before, and the year before, and the year before that." Of course the board knew about the strategic plan. Moreover, there's no question that J.P. Morgan knew about the strategic plan, and yet they were perfectly comfortable submitting a fairness opinion at $23 per share. There's also no evidence whatsoever that the strategic plan would have made any difference to the board's decision to approve this deal, even if somehow the board didn't know about it. First of all, the strategic plan was incomplete. Three different business units had provided their standalone targets for the next 3 years, but the work needed to synthesize that plan into a single comprehensive plan for the company had not yet been performed. And that is in, again, all over the record, 6 JA 1278 to 86, 6 JA 1168. And I would point this court specifically to 11 JA 2470, where the Newport company, Mr. Phillippe, when they gave the strategic plan to MKS, the acquirer, as part of the diligence process, because they were asked for it, they said they gave the report with lots of caveats about how the report was incomplete and not ready for prime time. And in fact, when MKS, the acquirer, saw the strategic plan as part of their diligence, they regarded it as unreliable and useless, and they did not use it in their own valuation of Newport. And that's at 5 JA 1070. So MKS, the acquirer, didn't use the strategic plan because they viewed it as Mr. Phillippe viewed it as incomplete and unreliable. Bank of America did not use it in their fairness opinion. And the board that knew about the strategic planning process and had access to the data room, of course, like any board would, didn't use the strategic plan or even ask about the strategic plan. Perhaps most importantly of all, the board already had two business plans before it when evaluating this merger. They had what was called the base case and they had the acquisition case. And in fact, the acquisition case, that one of the two cases that the board used to evaluate this merger, the acquisition case was actually higher than the strategic plan numbers. The strategic plan was essentially the middle case that fell between the base case and the acquisition case. So plaintiffs are asking this court to credit their argument that if only the board had had access to a middle case, a middle set of projections for the board that was still uncompleted and unreliable, that the board would not have sold the company at $23 per share. That is the type of argument, frankly, that wouldn't survive a motion to dismiss, let alone summary judgment after 3.5 years of litigation. And even if we were to credit all of this, credit plaintiffs with all of these arguments, they still would not be entitled to continue with their case because there is also no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Phillippe intentionally and in bad faith decided to conceal the strategic plan from the board as part of some grand fraudulent scheme to get the board to approve the deal. And that is required. Intentional bad faith conduct is required to be proven by the plaintiffs under Nevada's business judgment rule. Directors and officers in deciding upon matters of business, and Mr. Phillippe was both a director and an officer, are presumed to act in good faith and with a view to the interests of the corporation. So it is plaintiff's job to prove with evidence that Mr. Phillippe's decision not to provide the strategic plan to the board when it was incomplete at the time was done in bad faith. There's no evidence, none, to support that argument. There were no secret conversations between Mr. Phillippe and MKS, certainly not before the deal was announced. There were no conversations about compensation or Mr. Phillippe's role with the new company at all before the deal was announced. And in fact, although counsel for plaintiffs referred to some alleged evidence in the record, what actually is in the record, and it's on page 27 of our brief on appeal, is that both Mr. Phillippe and the MKS CEO, the acquirer's CEO, testified that there were no conversations about Mr. Phillippe's role or his compensation post-merger until the deal was announced. And by the way, what happened to Mr. Phillippe after this deal went through? Plaintiffs say he was worried about getting fired by the Newport Group, but he was not fired by Newport. He actually had his job the whole time. And the board never suggested that they intended to fire him. When MKS acquired the company, they fired him. So this is not a situation like Guzman, where Mr. Phillippe walked away with some fancy package and got to keep working for the company and made a lot of money from the deal. He was fired as a result of this deal. And unlike in Guzman, Mr. Phillippe was not a controlling stockholder. This is not a case like Guzman or the many other cases the plaintiffs cite where there's a special fiduciary duty owned by a controlling stockholder in a merger that buys out a minority of the stockholders. This was an arm's length deal between two completely independent companies, and Mr. Phillippe had no relationship whatsoever to the acquirer. So however you look at it, whether it's on the board's decision to approve the merger at $23 per share, whether it's on Mr. Phillippe and what his possible motive could have been to perpetrate this grand fraud on a very sophisticated board of directors, any way you look at this case, it is clear that the district judge got this right. After 3.5 years, the district judge said we have seen enough. There is no evidence to support this far-fetched theory. And then the plaintiffs tried at the last minute to amend the complaint after the close of discovery, and exercising discretion, and this court, of course, applies an abuse of discretion standard to orders denying leave to amend, exercising its discretion, the district court said no, that not only would your proposed amendment, quote, cause undue delay. We heard a lot from plaintiffs here about how the order denying leave to amend found their motion to be timely. But that's not actually what the court found. The court said that although it was timely under the agreed upon scheduling order, the court nonetheless denies the motion because the proposed amendment would cause undue delay. And that's not all. The court went on. The counsel for plaintiffs here today just told this court, quote, there was no finding of prejudice by the trial court. That is not correct. The trial court said, quote, it would be prejudicial to defendants and Mr. Cargill, end quote, if this complaint is allowed to be amended at this point in time. Why? Why did the court think it was going to be prejudicial? For many reasons that are laid out in the court's order. First and foremost, plaintiffs had earlier abandoned their prayer for rescission and rescissory damages when they amended the complaint the first time. And by the way, they amended the complaint a second time and again did not include a claim for rescissory damages. It was not until after the close of evidence, after their expert reports came in, that they suddenly sought to resuscitate a claim for rescissory damages 3 years later. That is too late. And why is it too late? Again, the order tells us that it was too late because it would essentially require a whole new round of discovery. When you are looking at rescissory damages, you have to analyze the post-merger performance of the companies, which is something that you absolutely do not analyze when arguing for breach of fiduciary duty. In fact, under black letter law, it is irrelevant to look at post-merger performance when arguing for breach of fiduciary duty. So allowing them to amend in a claim for rescissory damages would have required an entirely new round of discovery focused on an entirely new set of issues that now extended 3 years beyond the merger. So the longer the plaintiffs waited to bring back their claim for rescissory damages, the longer the time period that would then be subject to discovery. And the court found that was an abuse of, that would be prejudicial to the defendants. They also found that amending the complaint would be prejudicial to Mr. Cargyle. That's expressly in the order. And why is that? Again, because plaintiffs had told Mr. Cargyle in his deposition that he was not a defendant in this case. In fact, all of the facts that they were trying to allege against Mr. Cargyle, they had known from the very beginning of the case. Plaintiffs talk about the text messages and other things, but the district court, in deciding on the summary judgment motion, denied our motion to strike a separate statement of facts that included all of those same facts. So when the district court ruled on the summary judgment motion, it took into account and considered all of the facts that plaintiffs wanted to then amend into the complaint. It was already in their separate statement. So the court already had all those facts before it and still ruled that the summary judgment motion should be granted in defendant's favor.
Counsel?
For all of these, yes.
Justice Kadish in Carson City, let me kind of play devil's advocate with you for a minute here, right? So
yes.
Before looking for a merger suitor, if you will, there were some issues. The stock price had not been going up. There were complaints from apparently major shareholders. They ended up, having this agreement with MKS that went through. But as the board, in other words, should the board have, perhaps the reason the company wasn't making more money without the merger was if Mr. Phillippe wasn't an appropriate CEO, maybe he should have been fired and that would have been a better solution to making money for the shareholders than merging. I'm just sort of throwing that out there. Has that been discussed at all or a theory even presented?
That has not been plaintiff's theory of the case. I think, the board of directors certainly has within its discretion the ability to decide whether firing Mr. Phillippe as CEO and proceeding as a standalone company or accepting $23 per share in cash consideration from the acquirer, the board is certainly within its business judgment discretion able to decide which of those paths to pursue. But I would point this court, I think it's actually clearer than that. I would point this court to some of the testimony from the directors themselves when asked similar questions to the one Your Honor asked. The testimony of Peter Simone, for example, 7JA1391, and he was asked whether $23 was more favorable than other potential transactions. And he said, absolutely, quote, absolutely. In fact, we thought $23, if we stayed independent, was any of the models showed it out 4 to 5 years from $23, end quote. And there are other quotes, Mr. Kiken, who said, the company may or may not have come up with a better strategy, but from my perspective, it would take a long time to reorient the strategy, change the product focus, change the customer focus, and that would introduce a lot of years of uncertainty, and it may or may not have happened, but here we had a $23 significant premium to the current trading price on the table, and this is the value that our shareholders could recognize right away. So there you have it in the words of the directors.
Great. Let me just ask about one other thing then. One of the other potential merger candidates, there was a talk of a demand for a $25 share price as to some other one and maybe some implication that they then gave away the store with this candidate by going to 23. Can you address the reasoning and support on that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So at the point at which the $23 offer was on the table from MKS, there were no other bidders left. MKS put $23 on the table and asked for exclusivity so that they could have exclusive access to the company's data and data rooms, and the board decided to go ahead with that exclusivity. There was a suggestion in the record at one point, and plaintiffs misquoted. There was a suggestion that somebody had suggested maybe MKS would be willing to go a few dimes higher than $23. But ultimately, the feedback that the company received from Bank of America was that no, that they really weren't willing to go any further, and that if you tried to push them further on price,
Bank of America, is that, are you talking about J.P. Morgan? Or
I'm sorry, you're on J.P. Morgan, I apologize.
I just wanted to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
Yes, sorry about that, Your Honor. J.P. Morgan had given some back channel information saying that, you know, if you walk away from 23 and try to push the price higher, the deal might go away. And the board of directors considered all that. They decided not to press the acquisition price higher than $23 per share. They thought it would risk the acquirer MKS walking away. And so they did not go back on price. Again, perfectly within the board's discretion to make a decision like that. Perfectly sound decision and subject to the business judgment.
And J.P. Morgan was provided the draft such as it was of the strategic plan. Is that right?
That's correct. J.P. Morgan was given the draft of the strategic plan. It was told about all of the reasons why it shouldn't be used to value the company. It was told that it was preliminary, and it was told that it was not complete, and was told that it shouldn't be used for valuing the company, and J.P. Morgan didn't use it. J.P. Morgan ultimately used the base case to value the company. They decided that was the right case to use, and they valued the company at $23 per share using that case. But again, they had access to the strategic plan, which was the middle case, and they had access to the acquisition plan, which was the higher case, and J.P. Morgan did not use either of those in forming their fairness.
I guess, do you want to briefly address the jury issue to the extent we get to that?
Sure, Your Honor. I don't think Your Honors need to reach that issue for all the reasons we've discussed. I think if Your Honors do reach the jury issue, the Cohen case from this court decides that issue. In the Cohen case addressed a claim nearly identical to this one, a breach of fiduciary duty claim in the context of a merger. And the Cohen court, Your Honors, found that in that context, breach of fiduciary claims are equitable in nature. And in fact, one of the questions at issue in that case was whether the equitable doctrine of acquiescence was available as a defense against the claim. And this court decided, yes, it is available as a defense, even though it is equitable in nature, because the nature of the claim is equitable in nature. Of course, if the claim were not equitable in nature, then an equitable defense would not work. So this court has already decided that issue, and it makes sense. I mean, the type of claim that the plaintiffs are trying to bring here did not exist at common law. At common law, if you wanted to block a merger and you were a stockholder, you just voted against it, because at common law, mergers required the unanimous consent of stockholders. And so it wasn't until the statutory schemes started departing from common law and creating dissenters' rights that this type of claim emerged. And that's why the right to a jury trial in this type of claim did not exist in 1864 when the Nevada Constitution was enacted.
Anyone else have any questions?
No. Thank you very much, Your Honors. I would urge the court to affirm the lower court's decision, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Barron, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First and foremost, the entire story the counsel started with is actually the disputed facts. In this case, they weren't findings of the trial court. We disagree with fundamentally his entire interpretation. What he doesn't deal with primarily is the very issues that were before the court. He doesn't deal with the fact that the base case and the case that they used in the acquisition case, the management knew was actually overly pessimistic and were not run the company numbers. J.P. Morgan did not choose which case to use. J.P. Morgan used the case that management told them to use, that Felipe and Cargill specifically told them to use. There is a disputed fact as to whether or not there is actually the strategic case is actually the middle value. In fact, there's evidence that shows that it actually had greater profitability and earnings. So therefore, that which provides the value shows value. Again, the value that we have and what our expert reports show is that it was about $110 million greater in value than in the acquisition case.
Let me interrupt. So you're saying that J.P. Morgan, in giving their fairness opinion, relied on the projection that management told them to rather than using their independent judgment?
Absolutely. That is, in fact, in the fairness opinion letter, they expressly say they do not determine the reliability of the projections. And in their presentation, they expressly say that they are reliant, that their choice of projections or the choice of forecasts are those that management chooses. They don't make that decision. That's not what a fairness opinion is. Fairness from a financial point of view is based upon what management tells them. In this case, it was specifically Felipe and Carga.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, then. Thank you very much for your briefing and arguments today. This matter will stand submitted, and we are in recess until 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you for your